Hi, I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. This is the Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 31st, 2014. This show is about how to not only get more money out of the choices that you make in life, but more value. This week in How We Live Money, our personal economies and Washington's newest agenda. President Obama's State of the Union focused on the big picture of our wallets, from building jobs to closing the gender pay gap. But the biggest news was tied to the state of Americans' retirement savings.
Today, most workers don't have a pension. A Social Security check often isn't enough on its own. And while the stock market has doubled over the last 5 years, that doesn't help folks who don't have 401ks. That's why tomorrow I will direct the Treasury to create a new way for working Americans to start their own retirement savings. My IRA.
Here to discuss MyRA, how it's built, and what it means for you is Marketplace reporter Nancy Marshall Genzer. Nancy, welcome.
Hey, Carmen.
So, yeah, the reason for this season, I mean, the numbers in terms of Americans and their ability to save, they're pretty dismal, right?
Oh, Carmen, it's depressing. According to the White House, about half of all American workers don't even have access to an employer-sponsored retirement plan. But even of those who do, only one out of 10 workers actually contribute to an IRA voluntarily. So the president wants to do something about this.
So the president mentioned some really small amounts in terms of being able to start these accounts, hopefully encouraging folks who seem like they just don't have a lot of money to put into retirement. But the income cap on this plan is actually pretty high, right?
$191,000 a year, Carmen, which it seems like a lot. But if you live in a high-cost city like New York and you've got a family of five, with $191,000 a year, it really doesn't seem like that much money. And I think the Obama administration just wanted to make these plans available to as many people as possible.
Now, in terms of being appealing for savers, how is this being made appealing? Because it does seem, you know, he's throwing out numbers like, oh, just with $5 or $25. But there's aspects of this plan that are better than some of the other options you have out there.
Well, yeah, the fees for one, Carmen. As I was saying earlier, the big companies that sell these IRA products, yeah, they can charge a lot in the way of fees, and they also require a big down payment. The thing about the MyRA is you don't need a big down payment, and there are no fees. The other thing is you can withdraw your money before you retire without a penalty. With a traditional private sector IRA, if you withdraw before, 70 and a half, you have to pay a big penalty.
And there's no risk because there's no flexibility in terms of where this money is invested, correct?
That's right. I mean, they're going to be invested in U.S. government bonds. And so they are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. So it's a very safe investment. I guess the flip side of that is you're not going to have huge returns like we did on the stock market in 2013, but you're going to have a steady return and it's going to be very safe.
Yeah, and some folks are actually made to feel very nervous about investing in the market. So they feel like, I don't know how it works. I'm just not going to play. So maybe this safety feature can help. But there are some downsides to those limitations. For example, you know, I was surprised that this is not one of those opt-out programs versus opt-in.
Yeah, unfortunately, that would require legislation. That is something President Obama does want to do. The MyRA is something he can just do with an executive order. But the White House says every year President Obama has been in office, he has included an opt-out provision in his budget. And what I mean by that, and he's doing it this year for fiscal 2015 as well, what I mean by that is this year, he's proposing that every employer with more than 10 workers would have to offer retirement accounts for their workers, and the workers would be automatically enrolled. The money would automatically be taken out of their paycheck unless they opted out, unless they said, look, I don't want that money taken out. I don't want to participate in the plan.
Now, any buzz, though, in addition to this, on future, future changes to employer-sponsored retirement plans, any more changes down the pipe?
Not that I see. I think that's something the Obama administration would like to tackle. But in his budget for fiscal 2015, he is just tackling the employers who don't offer any kind of retirement plan at all. He's saying, look, if you've got 10 or more workers, you're going to have to offer a plan. Now, Congress would have to approve that. That would require legislation. We'll see what the House and Senate do with that.
One step at a time, right, Nancy?
That's right.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
See Nancy Marshall Genzer's latest on MyRA at MarketplaceMoney.org. Also, head over to there if you have questions about MyRA and how it can work. Click on Ask Carmen. This is Marketplace Money from APM. December 28th, 2013, it was a dark day for many Americans. This was when unemployment checks for the long-term jobless stopped coming for more than a million Americans out of work. The president addressed the loss of income in his State of the Union on Tuesday.
We can help Americans return to the workforce faster by reforming unemployment insurance so that it's more effective in today's economy. But first, this Congress needs to restore the unemployment insurance you just let expire for 1.6 million people.
So our unemployment rate may be the lowest in 5 years, but it's far from healthy. And these job numbers also hide some very stark realities. Mitchell Hartman has been covering long-term unemployment for Marketplace, and he joins us now with some insight. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Carmen. It's good to be here.
Talk us through where we're at in terms of the job numbers and unemployment numbers right now.
Well, Carmen, the reality is that unemployment is obviously coming down. You know, we see the numbers every month. Employers are creating jobs. The unemployment rate has been, you know, pretty steadily inching down. It's fallen in 39 states, but employers aren't adding all that many jobs. Now, in December, it was sort of a disaster. It was this weird month with bad weather and all sorts of things. Employers only added 74,000 jobs. Now, that is really poor. We'll get new numbers for January at the end of this week on Friday. You know, chances are they'll be sort of in this middling area that we've been around 200,000. That is enough to get the unemployment rate to sort of inch lower, but it is really not enough to reemploy millions of people who have been unemployed for 6 months or longer, the long-term unemployed. And that number is just really, really persistent, around 37, 38%.
Here's the thing. There's still only one full-time job for every three applicants. So it's creating this strange side effects, you know, many folks having to take jobs well below their experience, right?
Right. That's true. I mean, a lot of people are taking, you know, lower paying, lower skilled jobs, minimum wage jobs, whatever they can find. And look, that's where a lot of the new jobs are. Not all of them, but a lot of them are in services, you know. And the fact is that overqualified workers are taking some of the jobs, you know, in call centers or whatever low skill thing they can find. And that just leaves another sector of the workforce jobless. I talked to Nancy Shields. She's in her late 50s. She lives in Southern California. Now, she had steady work. She was a manager in a big retail chain for decades. She's now been unemployed for well over a year. When I talked to her at the end of December, she was about to lose those federal benefits.
It's now become such an employer's market that they no longer look at the length of employment that I had or the type of experience that I had. Now they're starting to look for education background, and I don't have a college degree, for example. I started working right out of high school.
You know, and so for her, here's the bottom line, and I think this is the same for a lot of long-term unemployed people.
I'm probably going to have to get a job if they're hiring at McDonald's or one of those places, but it won't be enough to cover my living expenses.
So, Mitchell, it's not necessarily completely hopeless for folks who don't have these checks anymore. Washington is still mulling if they can be reinstated. But in the meantime, tell us a little bit about the other proposals that are coming forth from Washington in helping the long-term unemployed.
Well, you know, ironically, both sides are talking job training. I mean, the president's been stumping for it, and the Republicans actually seem to be holding that out as one of the sort of requirements that if they do approve the restoration of these federal benefits, there should be job training kinds of requirements. The problem is that although everyone agrees that job training would be great, if you actually look at the numbers, it doesn't necessarily solve the problem because it doesn't create jobs. It just makes certain people better able to get the jobs that are there. And, you know, we do hear that there are a lot of jobs for skilled workers, manufacturing workers. A lot of those people who are very skilled are baby boomers. They're starting to retire. There may not be people who know how to, you know, use a cutting machine, know how to weld. But if you teach someone to do that, it doesn't necessarily get someone who's long-term unemployed re-employed. I talked to Gary Bertless. He's a labor economist at the Brookings Institution about this.
Can we help an individual person who's been jobless for 6 or 12 months get employed faster? Yes, we can. But the problem might be that by getting that person employed in a depressed job market, we're pushing someone else out of the job opening who otherwise would have obtained it.
It's incredibly difficult to budget if you just don't have income. It's hard to cut up a pie if you don't have the pie, right? So one listener named Phil wrote to us and said, quote, "I don't need advice. I need cash." That's a really stark reality. What are you hearing from folks that like Phil?
Look, I hear the same thing. It's just lasting longer and longer for people. And, you know, that may be a reality that's with us that's sort of here to stay. Now, you know, anybody who's unemployed, whether or not they were getting an unemployment check, look, they've already tightened their belt. They already know how to budget. They better, or they're probably already out on the street and they've lost their car and they've lost their home. So, you know, it's difficult to talk to somebody like that about sort of, you know, get your financial ducks in a row, you know, do more financial planning. The economy just doesn't have enough jobs for all these people right now, and it is really tough.
It is. Thank you so much, Mitchell, for joining us.
You're welcome, Carmen. It's been a pleasure.
For the latest on unemployment and job creation by Mitchell Hartman, head to marketplacemoney.org and also head over there for my advice on what to do when those checks stop coming. Coming up, ladies, speaking up means making more money. We explain.
If you sit back and don't ask and don't offer up what you've done, then you won't get that promotion or that title or that bonus.
Next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong-Ulrich. Let's get to your questions.
Carmen.
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 Carmen. Carmen, what's going on?
I'm here for you. Andrew joins us from Chicago. He and his fiance, Kate, getting married. And you know what comes with that. Save the date cards, dress fittings, DJ hirings. But most importantly, a conversation about what to do about combining money. First of all, Andrew, congratulations and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us today. But you have some questions about this going from two households to one.
We wanted to know, you know, a couple of questions around basically how do we combine our finances and how do we prioritize our saving and spending?
When you say combine your finances, everyone has a very different definition as to what that means. What does it look like to you when you say combine?
Well, we're hoping to get a good picture of that because our parents do it one way, our friends do it another. And, you know, we've talked about combining everything in terms of co-signing on credit cards and direct depositing into a single account. But don't know if that's the right thing to do or if there's another way to approach it.
Right is relative. So let's just get that out of the way. So, and you're both earning income. So the question is just a matter of degrees, really, at this point. Because like you said, some people, your parents, I'm assuming, combined everything. Is
yes.
that correct? Okay. And then some of your friends are like, no, don't do it. Keep everything separate.
That's about it.
The middle ground, which I'm a big fan of because it does two things. One is you want to combine and know what's going on and have this feeling that you're a family and the money that you bring in goes to that family and that household eventually. You want that, but you probably also want some sense of autonomy, I would suspect, or else you would just go full hog and put everything together. And one thing, a bit of advice I give to a lot of new couples is have a household account. A household checking account, a household savings account. And those accounts are where your percentage, let's say, of the money you bring home goes to take care of household bills and expenses. And the savings can be for goals that you guys have together, whether it's buying a home or taking annual vacation. But you can also keep your own accounts, checking and savings, for, let's say, you know, you want to go for a weekend with the guys or she wants to, you know, buy herself something without affecting the household goals. That's something you can do. But Andrew, you have a question about credit, because credit is something completely different than those cash accounts.
Right. And we both have credit cards that are in our own names, and we also have some holdover student debt. We've talked about just, you know, combining that, and I'm going to take on some of her debt and vice versa. Didn't know if that was the same thing for cards and how to approach that.
You want to just think about also maintaining your own credit. And let me raise a point that you brought up right at the top. You said, if something happens to either of us, and this is a very important thing to think about when it comes to your credit, you both want to make sure that you have credit in your name, always, separately, always, if only because, as you mentioned, if something happens to one of you, whether it's you lose your job or someone passes away, someone has, between the two of you, will have access to credit. So that's very important. But having a household account is definitely something you can do that can help with managing the finances.
Okay. So we both have some assets coming into this, and we're also planning on renting for a while and saving up for a house. When, you know, as we're putting away money for a down payment and, you know, putting away a percentage for a rainy day, and you know, we have some student debt and we're probably, you know, looking for a car and all the things that come in our late 20s, what kind of account or what kind of vehicle do we put our funds in? Is index funds, you know, safe enough? Should we do some sort of bonds? You know, what do we keep that money in?
You just had, for folks listening right now, when you just said index funds and bonds and safe all in the same sentence, everybody just went, no, that's any kind of market, exposing your liquid assets to a market, even if it's well diversified, like with an index fund, let's say a Dow index or an S&P index, there's still a tremendous amount of risk in there. So what you want to do, and I say tremendous, meaning because you need the money to remain liquid, you need access to it, and you can't necessarily afford to lose it because you're trying to build it up.
Right.
So I definitely recommend, I know that feeling of it's not growing, it's shrinking because of inflation. That money is insurance. Your emergency fund is insurance. So the 1% that you lose, let's say you get a money market account, no cost, no fees, go shopping online, you can find one, or a savings account that gets you back 1%, with the way inflation is going, yeah, you're going to lose 1% a year, but guess what? That's all you're going to lose.
Right.
You're not going to lose anymore.
Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you so much for calling in. And if you have a question that you'd like to hear answered on air, head over to marketplacemoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. In his State of the Union speech, President Obama reminded us that the workplace is still not an equal playing field for women.
Women make up about half our workforce, but they still make 77 cents for every dollar a man earns. That is wrong. And in 2014, it's an embarrassment. Women deserve equal pay for equal work.
Well, it's hard not to bravo that. A new study out of Montana State University sheds more light on one reason why women are not treated or compensated as well as men on the job. And it explores the stereotype that women who are willing to speak about their accomplishments are somehow doing a bad thing and that it alienates others, while work culture rewards that same behavior for men. Psychologist Jessie Smith was the lead researcher on this study, and she joins us now. Welcome, Jessie.
Hello, thank you.
And also with us is Peggy Klaus. She's the author of the best-selling book, Brag, The Art of Tooting Your Own Horn Without Blowing It. Peggy, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Jesse, I'm going to start with you. What drove you, motivated you at first to do this study? It was something very specific.
That's right. Several years ago, I was chair of our Women's Faculty Caucus, and we had the bright idea to put together a newsletter that highlighted the accomplishments of the women faculty at our university. So we sent out an email to our listserv and said, tell us about the great things that you've done recently. It could be a research accomplishment, something in teaching, maybe a new hobby that you've learned. So we kept it pretty generic. And we got exactly zero responses.
Wow.
Just a real reluctance and discomfort to announce to the small world of Bozeman, Montana, the accomplishments that they had been so successful at securing over the last year.
Yeah. And, you know, we wanted to hear some voices out there. And here's what it sounds like for a lot of women today.
I don't like to pat myself on the back. I feel like people will just appreciate what you do. And if they don't, it's not really my job to point it out to them how, quote unquote, good I've done. I've never asked for a raise at work. I'm kind of there to do my job. If they feel that they want to reward me, then that's on them. I don't feel that it's my place to say, hey, I need more money, please.
I am not as confident as I think I should be when talking about my accomplishments at work. I try to keep a list of the things that I have accomplished, so that way I'll remember them when it comes review time. I have actually asked for a raise, and it's actually been very slow going, and as it hasn't actually occurred, it's been about a year and a half long process through two bosses.
That was Tammy and Crystal from D.C. Peggy, what are the pressures that make things so different between men and women when it comes to promoting yourself in the workplace?
There are social and cultural, religious and familial norms, Carmen, that prevent women from saying, I am proud of myself for this accomplishment. Certainly, if 2008 and the recession has taught us anything, that if you sit back and don't ask and don't offer up what you've done, then you won't get that promotion or that title or that bonus.
Jesse, talk to us about your experiment. Tell us about what you did.
We wanted to come up with a situational, some external reason, a justification that could explain away why you might be feeling uncomfortable. If you have something external to blame for that, then it frees you up. So we had groups of undergraduate women at Montana State University who were applying for a scholarship, and we told them, write either an application essay for yourself or to write a letter of reference and promote the accomplishments of a friend to win this essay. And for half of them, we told them that there was a subliminal noise generator in the room. Let me be clear. It's not really a noise generator. It didn't actually produce any crazy sounds, but we made them think that it would produce these high-pitched frequencies that would potentially make them feel uncomfortable, feel anxiety. And so if they felt that way, it was the result of this subliminal black box. And what was fascinating was that for the half that we told them about this black box, if they had to write about their own accomplishments for the scholarship essay, they enjoyed the experience more. And when women were able to have this black box to blame for any discomfort that they might have been feeling, they wrote better essays and received $1,000 more on average in scholarship money.
Jesse, I just want to say that I'm fascinated by your research. I take a very different approach. And I have found over these many years that when I provide women with a way to talk about themselves with no negative perceptions of being self-aggrandizing, aggressive, and give them a practice technique along with that to get over their discomfort and their nerves, then they feel much more comfortable and they really get that they can do it and that they need to do it. And I have seen a real shift in women who would come to me and say, I can't brag. It's a sin. It's pride cometh before the fall. It's not ladylike. You know, I talked about the cultural and the societal norms, and that's what we're up against.
Jesse, we're talking a lot about a lot of responsibility for women to take on.
That's right. And quite frankly, it is a lot of burden to retrain yourself. And then if you don't do it, well, then it's your own dang fault that you don't make as much money as somebody else and you didn't get that raise and promotion. So there's a blaming of the victim that can potentially happen here. We would suggest, from a social psychological perspective, that the burden is on the employers. The only way these cultural norms are going to change is to change the culture. For example, instead of just saying, write your annual review, have it be a form that asks very pointed questions. How many conferences did you go to? How many stories were you the lead author on? It might seem soulless because there's no room for narrative, but it does normalize this notion of talking about your accomplishments in a way that is actively sought out by the employer, and men and women are taking part in this in an equal way. And certainly, why isn't the question, why do we reward this behavior in men? Nobody likes somebody who's just bragging and conceited and talking about themselves nonstop.
Right. And I wish upon all ladies equal pay for equal work. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Peggy, thank you as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Carmen.
Psychologist Jesse Smith is from Montana State University, and Peggy Klaus is the author of Brag, The Art of Tooting Your Own Horn Without Blowing It. If you want to tell your story about work, wages, and being a woman, head over to marketplacemoney.org or tweet at LiveMoney. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. So here at Marketplace Money, we get a lot of questions, and we love to answer as many as we possibly can. Hence, the lightning round. This week, we're joined by Ben Johnson from the Marketplace Tech Report. He's here to keep me at light speed. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Carmen.
Talk to me, Ben.
All right. Well, you got 5 minutes to answer a bunch of questions. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Go. Matthew from Yonkers, New York. He's lost in Yonkers. He has this question. What steps should I take to avoid identity theft?
Don't carry your Social Security card or give your number to anyone. That's a number one thing, folks don't understand. Absolutely do that. I would say instead of signing up for all these services and paying people to do what you can do, head into your banking account and your credit card accounts online once a week at a minimum, if not every other day or so. And just make sure that things are going right. If you see something funny, make a phone call.
That's good, because you don't, you see, it's like, you know, when you take the trash out.
Exactly.
Once a week, just do it.
Just do it. And also this, don't use your debit card to buy things online, please, because that's your cash money. A credit card by law protects you. Got it?
Very interesting. Okay, I got another one. Marion from Cincinnati, Ohio. This is another investing question. My husband and I are in our early 60s. We're 100% in stocks. We want to put money in bonds and in the bond market, but we hear bonds are a bad place to be.
Listen, Ben, any investment at a point in time can be a bad place to be. But in your 60s, to have everything in the stock market, much, much too risky. I would never recommend anybody do that.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Danger, danger. I can remember how many folks reached out when the market crashed, the beginning of recession. Folks in retirement in their 60s had everything in the market. You don't have time to recover that money. Not that you need it all at once, but you should not be more than 50% in the stock market. And you need to be diversified. You don't want to put all that money into the bond market. You want to have some in stocks, some in bonds, some in money markets. You want to make sure that you spread your risk around. And I would say to Marion, sit down with an hourly planner to go over this, okay?
Okay.
Find one at fpanet.org, CFP. .com, and make sure that you get somebody that can work with you and put things where they're safer.
Diversify. All right. Jill from Flagstaff, Arizona. She asks, what happens to the debt of a person that dies without a will? So if a blood relative of mine dies, who's responsible for the debt they've accumulated, such as a line of credit or a mortgage? I hope she's not planning on killing someone.
Jill. Ben, no. But Jill, oh, this is one of my favorite questions of all time because it's a question that folks don't ask until it happens to them.
Yes, until it's too late.
For example, a parent passes away and they start, the adult children start getting calls from collection agencies. You are not responsible for your parents' debt.
Ooh, I didn't know that.
You are not responsible for a blood relative's debt at all. Whatever debts they have and they pass with get taken out of their estate. So let's say you were planning on getting $100,000 from their estate, but they have 20 grand in outstanding debt. The 20 comes out of the 100, you get the 80. Now you may say, hey, that's my money, but that's where it goes. You are not liable for their debt.
This is great news.
Know that.
All right.
I don't know. You're a little too happy about that one. Be careful. I'm calling your mama.
I got another one from Arizona, Mary from Tucson. She wants to know, what are the current tax laws regarding capital gains for a home sale? Explain this. Help us out.
Mary, listen, you can make a sweet $250,000 tax-free on the gains on a primary residence per person
nice.
If you're single, right? Quarter mil, not bad.
You're not bad.
If you own it as a couple, you're up to $500,000 tax-free. This is due to the Taxpayer Relief Act of 2007. Know this, though. You've got to be careful. This is a primary residence only.
Aha.
Okay.
I can't sell my my Boca condo.
Hey, listen, if you got a condo in Boca, I got a bridge to sell you.
All right, I got one more. We got a few seconds left. Christian from Duluth, he says, Carmen, love the show. He decided at the end of this year, New Year's resolution, to contribute more to his 401k or his retirement fund. His employer 401k is already maxed out. Should he look for another option or investment vehicle?
Absolutely, Christian. Vehicle, vroom, vroom, head over to a Roth IRA if
you
fit under the income requirements, or get a traditional, head over to IRS.gov to see what's right for you.
All right, Carmen, well done. Time is up. You have answered five questions. Nicely done, my friend.
Well, I thank you, and I answered some of yours as well. Thank you, Ben, for joining us.
I'm not going to worry about my parents' debt anymore.
There you go.
Bye,
now you
Carmen.
Can find answers to these questions at marketplacemoney.org. Click on Lightning Round and submit your own questions. Visit the website and look for Ask Carmen. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Carmen.
Just ahead, Super Bowl bets, heads or tails?
More people are betting this than anything else, which means you've got some people making only one sports bet a year, and it is on the Super Bowl.
Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. You know, advertisers aren't the only ones spending some big bucks on Super Bowl Sunday. A recent survey found that on average, Americans spend a little over $68 a piece on game day, mostly on food and bowl gear. But in addition to the chicken wings, the beer, the team jerseys, there's another $99 million being wagered in Nevada. Now, that's just the legal stuff. Here to talk to us about game day spending action of a different sort is RJ Bell. He's a sports betting expert and the founder of pregame.com. Welcome, RJ.
I'm absolutely happy to be here. Super Bowl is the one time that everyone is interested in Vegas and a little sports betting.
Yeah, right? I mean, this is huge. That $90 million, that's just in one place. We know that a lot of this stuff happens in other ways. Can you give us a big picture on how much is being spent betting, both in Vegas and maybe not in Vegas?
Yeah, I like the way you whisper when you talk about the other places. You know, last year actually was a record in Nevada. $99 million was bet. This year, consensus opinion is that record's going to be broken, so we will be 100 million plus is the expectation. But that is just Nevada. Well, how much of the total is Nevada? About 1%. Only 1% is legal and regulated here in Nevada. That means if you extrapolate out, $10 billion will be bet on this game worldwide. That is expected to be another record.
Okay, this is a huge industry in and of itself. But, you know, give us an idea. In the U.S., you know, who bets on the Super Bowl? Is there a general demographic or does this shoot across the board?
The estimate here in Nevada is 90% of the people who bet will be recreational bettors as opposed to professional bettors. That is the highest percentage of recreational bettors of any American sporting event. So the simplest answer I can give you is more people are betting this than anything else, which means you've got some people making only one sports bet a year, and it is on the Super Bowl. Now, why do they do that? It's not so much you're betting with a bookie. It's not even so much you're coming to Vegas to bet. It's social. It's an office pool. It is a party where there's squares where you can just randomly have a square and have a chance to win. You don't have to have expertise to want to be involved. In fact, for a lot of people, if you're not involved with a little something on the game, you feel left out. By some estimates, over half of adult Americans will have something at risk on this game.
Well, and the thing is, it's not just about the game, right? I mean, you talk to the entertainment factor here. Folks make bets on the craziest things, like how long it takes to sing the national anthem, or will Bruno Mars wear a hat or not? Doesn't it just run the gamut? It's almost anything.
And the purpose of those prop bets, which are proposition bets outside of the game itself, is to interest the non-fan. If you look at a regular season of the NFL, week 12, let's say randomly, you've got the fans, the hardcore NFL people betting that week. The difference between an average regular season week and the Super Bowl is the other bettors, and they're not big fans, so they don't want to bet on how many yards Peyton Manning is going to throw for or anything like that. They want to bet on things like the coin toss, and you might laugh and say, wait, you can bet on the coin toss before the game? In fact, that's one of the biggest prop bets there is. It's simple. People understand it, all the way, as you said, to the national anthem length, all the way to the color of the Gatorade being poured on the winning coach. So it really is about how do you get the casual fan who is only maybe watching this one NFL game involved. That's what the sportsbooks try to do with these alternative props.
Oh my gosh, RJ. It's having too much fun because I'm going to now watch the game with very different eyes. What can people bet on? So here's the thing. Let's just say, I'm not particularly a gambler, but let's say you got $20, you got $100. You know, for folks who do this once a year, those guys, those regular folks, how can you both increase your odds of making a big return on that?
Well, if you go for a big return, you pay a premium. The average sports bettor, the average human being, likes to risk a little bit to win a lot. Well, the sportsbooks know that, so they charge a premium. So if you are going for a 10-to-1 shot or a 20-to-1 shot, probably not getting the best bet. But remember, like Warren Buffett talks about, he thinks over the long run his stock picks are going to make money. But he says on any given day or given week or even given month, he can't tell you which way any stock is going to go. It's the same thing with professional bettors in Vegas. Over the long run, they're going to win about 55% of their games. That allows them to live in a big house and not work a day job. But on any given game, there's a 45% chance they're going to lose.
Oh, RJ, you quoted Buffett. I'm so enamored of you right now.
You know, I had that especially set up for you. So,
why, thank you, sir. You know, and for folks out there who understand this, if you're betting in Vegas, there are some tax implications. But if you're betting outside of Vegas, well, I don't have much advice for you. RJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Enjoy the game.
Thanks. RJ Bell is founder of pregame.com. So I want to know, what are you betting on this weekend? Tweet it at Live Money. This is Marketplace Money from APM. So more folks are getting married or remarried much later in life. And there's something about blending those mature finances that can bring up a lot of questions.
Carmen, what's going on?
We're going to head over to Connecticut. We're going to talk to Susie. Susie's 54 years old. She's engaged to someone who, well, let's just say, has done incredibly well. But Susie also had a great corporate job, paid six figures. She's done really well with some investments. So she wants to know what the next step should be when it comes to merging money. Susie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Susie, what's your overall kind of question about the two of you doing well in different ways?
So we got engaged a couple of years ago, and because there's no babies pending or that sort of thing, it's kind of gotten convenient to stay away from the conversation about how do you effectively mingle, you know, assets and all of that as we are in our later years. And my fiance has done very well, very, very well, a lot better than I have. And I am very reluctant to put the burden on him, yet he's offered. So we're just trying to figure out what's the right mix. You know, I have my own money, he has his. But I also, you know, I have this corporate life and I'm ready to give it up. But I also want to make sure I have really thought through the long term in case, as we know with love,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not a sure thing. And we've both been through the divorce situation. So, you know, just want to make sure that I'm doing the best that I can with the assets that I have.
Yeah, I want to ask you, Susie, you used the word burden. You said you don't want to be a burden.
Well, you know, I've lived my own life, paid my own way, put my children through college, you know, and had planned to fund my own retirement. But with a change, you know, because he's 10 years older than I am, he's ready to retire and do other things. And if I give up my income, you know, the daily living falls on his shoulders. And I'm just something in my, you know, boomer generation where I was raised to be the super mom and juggle all the balls, it's just kind of it'll be a new paradigm.
I totally get that, Susie. You're an independent woman. You've had your career. So he wants to retire and he would like you to retire with him, right?
Right.
Is giving up the career, or do you have any fears about getting back into the business if you needed to? Or is this all wrapped up in our independent womanness?
You know, probably a little bit of both. I think, you know, obviously worst case scenario, and we've been together for almost 5 years. So, you know, what happens if 2 years into it, he's like, well, you know, I want to do something else or be with somebody else. And then, of course, I'm, you know, that's the worst case scenario. Then I think I've given up my job. And if I'm not super careful with the way I've invested the money that I've got now, that I would really wake up with a dark cloud over my head and go, holy cow. And I'm very risk averse, which is why I have, you know, $100,000+ in my checking account.
Have you expressed to him that concern about, you know, listen, I'm giving up a career and this could be damaging to me should, and I'll bring up this other specter, which I think every couple, especially if you're getting married older, should think about. If somebody passes away earlier than you'd like or you think, you know, what happens? Have you guys discussed prenups or are you not even going there?
Yes, we've discussed prenups and I'm on his will as the sole inheritor of the estate and the property. And he was super willing to do that. I said, when I move in with you, you know, I really want this. I don't want somebody else to be able to kick me out of the house and upset my lifestyle. So that's
my criteria
for moving in. And he was wonderful about that. Then I went to start the prenup process. And my lawyer said, well, you know, he should put $5 million into escrow and just leave it there in case, you know, something happens to the marriage. And I came back to him and I kind of laughed. I said, that sounds ridiculous. So he said, you know, that I'm committed to you for the rest of my life. You have my word on that, blah, blah, blah. And then, but I think it's only fair that, you know, I would give you an annualized amount if we broke up, but that you come in with what you had and leave with what you had. And
right.
I would do the same.
Ooh, but he's willing to put aside a certain, like, $1 million for every year that you're together type situation.
Well, I don't know I don't think he would do that.
Ah. If you do break up, he doesn't want to have to give you anything.
Yeah.
Because Susie, this is getting really deep here. So just
I know,
so
it's
you
really
know.
Tricky.
Well, it is tricky because here's the thing. You know, nobody gets married thinking, yay, I'm going to divorce. You know, it's just everybody gets in saying, oh, of course, I'm saying these vows, I mean them. But, you know, divorce happens. It from a divorcee. And it's almost impossible for you. So even though when I saw your question, I was going in a very much more practical crunch numbers way, this is a big picture question, Susie,
right.
Because if you think of this, and that's what prenups are for, really, not only to just make sure that you keep what's yours and he keeps what's his, is if he's asking you to drop a career and to give that up, there's a price that you're paying for,
right.
That.
And, you know, and then the question is, who's asking? Like, you know, he doesn't say, I demand you to quit your job. He's saying, right. If you want to, you know, I would love to have you and I'll support you. And I'll, you know, he pays for the house and the cars and the trips and all of that. He pays for all of that. You know, but he's not saying you must quit your job.
It's very much the situation where some folks may be listening and going, I wish I had that problem. But guess what? It is a problem. For every year that you're giving up your corporate career, it's not just 1 year salary. It is also pensions or 401ks. You have access to a 401k.
Yeah.
It's earned income there. It's contributions for your retirement. And then if, let's say, you were to drop out for 5 years and attempt to go back in, you'd probably go back in and maybe a huge cut, you know, a third less, half less. So you'll actually lose money. So you have cash, you have the 401k. But I would say, Susie, at your age and at your level corporate-wise, having $500,000 in assets would not be able to get you through retirement.
Oh, I know that. Exactly.
If you can continue contributing to the 401k, that big chunk of cash, maybe you could reduce it a little bit, crunch your new expenses. Your expenses have probably changed a lot.
Yeah, I went from, you know, funding a house and cars to moving in with my fiancé, and I don't have any expenses.
That's amazing. But you still want a little bit. So I would say, you know, definitely keep a portion of that. If I were you to be comfortable at maybe somewhere 50, 60 in liquid, so that you always have that. And then the rest of it, you know, look at some traditional IRAs where you can put some of the money away and invest it fairly, you know, you're a conservative person, but just so that you're earning something tax-free on it.
Yep, and I think you're right. This is about opening up and tightening down this conversation around this prenup.
Susie, so will you let us know how it goes? Keep in touch.
I will. That's great. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
When you were growing up, what was money like for you and your family? We all have stories about how our parents helped shape the way we live money. Today, a favorite nonfiction author talks about show, not tell. Her parents didn't have to tell her what to do with money. She just learned by example.
I'm Mary Roach. I'm an author. My mom was a secretary at Dartmouth College, and my dad was a professor of speech. I should say he was an assistant professor because he never got his PhD, so they never made him full professor. So we didn't have a lot of money growing up. I don't remember any conversations about money. I mean, I think you learn by example. My parents were very frugal. Our bathroom, my mom, the full extent of her frilly, pretty, scented, beautiful potions and lotions. My mom had a plastic Jergens lotion, the kind with the nurse on it. So you knew this wasn't to make you feel pretty and feminine. It was like a medical product. And the other thing was witch hazel, which scared me a lot. I'm also, my husband, he's like me, we take the little, you know, in the soap, the bar of soap is worn down to a little sliver. You don't throw that away. You paste it onto the back of the mama soap, the big soap, and then you don't waste it. I must have seen my parents do that because otherwise it's insane. Who does that? My parents gave me piggy banks. So that, I guess if your parents give you a piggy bank, they're trying to say saving money is a good and fun thing to do. You know, I don't remember rolling my eyes going, oh my God, my parents are so cheap. I just thought my parents were normal. When I was 12 years old with the winnings from bingo, where you cover, what's it called, with blackout, when you cover the whole card. And I won. I won that. It was very exciting. I won $60. I didn't buy anything. I didn't splurge. I opened a savings account. That's what I did. And that's kind of how I am all these years later. I think you just learn by example. You just see how your parents are. That's your normal. When I was a kid, I didn't know we were poor, cheap, living on a budget. I had no sense of that. But one thing, looking back, the fact that we never left the country on vacation, we never really went anywhere. So for many years before I started writing books, for about 15 years, I wrote magazine features. And being cheap was a way to get overseas assignments. Like I wanted to do a story in Mozambique. Okay, I would figure out another story nearby so I could split the travel expenses between the two. I would stay in, you know, pensions, little places. I wouldn't stay in nice hotels. I'd stay in really little cheap, grubby places. So I was able to pitch a story overseas for less than what a lot of writers would be charging to do it in the United States. So I traveled all over the place, and that was my priority, and it was fabulous.
Now, some say cheap, I'll say frugal. Mary Roach is the author of Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. It's going to be out on paperback in April. You can find out more about Mary at maryroach.net. Send us your own lessons in family finance. We want to hear them. Tweet them at Live Money or record your story at marketplacemoney.org. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, do you need to make more money outside of your full-time job? Or maybe you just want to work for yourself. We've got some how-to on building multiple income streams. And as always, I'll be answering your money questions. We're here for you. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, Dan Sematovich, Candice Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Special thanks this week to Mark Solinger and Tobin Lowe. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember, always check with your financial pro before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.